before we get to practical instruction in meditation for optimum health, I wanted to talk a bit about disease as a general concept. The word disease literally means a lack of ease or a lack of comfort. And if you think about it, most of us live in a state of dis-ease. An interesting way to look at that is what happens if you just try to do nothing, that within a very short time, you have to move some part of your body because it becomes uncomfortable. It's very hard for us to stay in the moment, being still and feeling satisfied. There is a very strong need to change things, whether that's changing things at the mental level, changing things at the emotional level, changing things at the physical level. And that core dis-ease seems to be a fundamental quality of human life. I think of that as probably what was meant in the first noble truth of Buddhism, that life is suffering, that there is some fundamental quality about the experience of living which includes dis-ease, or however you want to look at that. Maybe suffering is too strong a term, but some kind of discomfort, lack of satisfaction, lack of completeness, feeling of something missing. And to me, this touches on the larger purposes of meditation and maybe the larger concept of health and healing and why meditation is important in that larger realm as well. The second noble truth in Buddhism was that the cause of this dis-ease is attachment. And when I think about what attachment means, one of the images that comes to mind from my own experience is a dog worrying a bone. And I think it's very interesting that we use that term worry for the action of a dog with a bone. I have two dogs, and at the moment, the particular bone that they've gotten onto is a deer antler that they found on my property. And they take turns, not always willingly, in worrying it. But when one gets a hold of it, he might spend an hour or more with that bone. And it's licking it, chewing it, turning it around, working it from every angle. And there are times when I look in the dog's eyes and I know, I mean, there's a moment of shared consciousness when I can see that the dog is under a kind of compulsion to do that, and it would give anything not to have to do that, but it can't stop. You know, sometimes it's like a moment when the dog is almost exhausted, and it steps back for a moment, but then that circuit clicks in again, and it has to keep going. Sometimes it ends because the dog drops into unconsciousness and falls asleep, and then the other dog grabs onto the antler. But there is that kind of compulsive attachment to the object. Now, clearly, the object doesn't have any inherent power to do that. This is something that is some relationship between consciousness and the object of the worrying, the object of attachment. But I think it's very interesting that in these fundamental teachings of Buddhism, that there is a recognition that at the core of our experience is this kind of dis-ease, that the cause of it is that kind of attachment, which I see symbolized in that image of a dog worrying a bone, and that the cure for this is the realization that there is some kind of state of freedom from that possible, and that one of the ways of achieving that kind of freedom is through the practice of meditation. On a practical level, it seems to me that the way most of us are in relation to our thoughts is very much like the way my dogs are in relation to that deer antler. That is, that thoughts are always there. John Kabat-Zinn spoke of dropping below the level of thought. There is a level of the mind in which thoughts are constantly being produced, and they're produced in a kind of orderly fashion. They're associated with each other. Thoughts are linked. One thought leads automatically to the next thought. There is some linkage of association. One of the images I have there is of cartoons in which there were machines that produced sausages, and the sausages are coming out links endlessly. So there's the sausage-making thought machine in the mind. It's just a component of the mind. It's always doing it. It never stops. And I think it is a mistake in the early stages of meditation to imagine that you can stop that process. I think that being given the instruction to stop thinking is a very unhelpful instruction in meditation. Rather, I think what you want to do is to learn to cultivate some kind of separation from that, or to learn that it's possible not to pay attention to that process. The sausages are coming out, but you don't have to look at them, or you don't have to get emotionally triggered by them. In medical terms, it seems to me when I interact with patients, I detect that their unhappiness, their anxiety, their depression, their grief, often the origin of these feelings is thoughts. And if they could simply learn not to pay attention to those thoughts, they would gain a great deal of freedom over those emotional processes and whatever damage that might be doing to their physical systems. John Kabat-Zinn mentioned that the process of meditation or meditative states, that it's difficult for this to be transferred from one person to another. But I think that there is something that can be, if not transferred, stimulated by being in the presence of somebody who has mastery at meditation. There is some way in which I think our consciousness is something like a crystal, and the phenomenon of crystal resonance goes on between people, that the vibrational levels of consciousness mutually interact with each other, so that if you are in the presence of an agitated mind, your mind will tend to become agitated. If you're in the presence of a still mind, your mind will tend to become still. I think on a very practical level, this is one reason for examining the relationships you have and trying to spend more time with people whose minds are in calmer states that reinforce those in you. And it points up to me the value of having more physicians out there who have some skill in this department. In the program in integrative medicine that I direct at the University of Arizona, the focus here is on training physicians on developing new models of medical education. And very fundamental in that new model is meditation practice, that I would like to see more physicians out there who have had practice at meditation. And I think it would be enormously valuable for patients, especially patients who come in agitated states of worry about their physical conditions, to be in the presence of physicians who are calm and are trained to remain calm in the presence of people who are fearful, anxious, agitated, worried. I think that can be enormously helpful. So I think one of the goals of meditation practice, the larger goals, is gaining some kind of freedom or spaciousness from the habitual addiction to thought and the thinking process, to being able to drop the bone and not worry it, to even not look at the bone if it's there, to cultivate greater time with a sense of ease. I think it's also useful in this practice to realize that there is some part of our mind that is already in that state. That is, there is some part of our experience which is always in meditation, which is always centered in that space of freedom and non-attachment, and that rather than trying to acquire something that's not part of us, we're trying to learn to identify our awareness with that part of ourself which already is enlightened, which already is in meditation. You know, maybe that corresponds with one of the teachings in the yogic literature that when we are in deep dreamless sleep, we are in the highest state of consciousness. The problem is that we're unaware. So that if one could learn to bring awareness into that same state, we would be enlightened. At any rate, that state is already part of ourselves. And just let me tell you a little story from my own history, which to me illustrates the great power of these techniques. When I was first starting my integrative practice, a young man came to me as a patient in his 20s. He was suffering from recurrent episodes of boils all over his body. These were staph infections, severe. And he had been treating these with rounds of antibiotics, which would cause a temporary disappearance, but as soon as he stopped the antibiotics, the boils would come back worse than before, and he'd been now through a number of cycles of antibiotics, and the doctors were running out of antibiotics to try, and he was very upset about his condition, and he arrived at my house in a state of great mental agitation. And I listened to him, I let him talk, and I began by first of all explaining to him that these bacteria that were causing these infections were normal inhabitants of his skin, and the problem was not to eliminate them, but to learn to live in balance with them, and it was possible to have the bacteria there and not have boils. And I also told him that I thought his use of antibiotics was actually worsening his problem because it was selecting clones of bacteria that were more virulent and less likely to live in balance, and that the first thing he was going to have to do was to stop using the antibiotics. He got very upset at that and told me that he thought it was irresponsible of me as a physician to tell him not to use antibiotics. And I said, well, nonetheless, that's my take on the situation. And then I looked him in the eye, and I knew I had engaged his attention, and I told him I would like him to go home and sit down and meditate on his skin as an interface between himself and the universe. And, you know, I knew I had made an impression on him. He looked at me very peculiarly, and I said then to report back to me. Well, he did report back to me in 2 weeks. He stopped using the antibiotics, and he did do the meditations, and the boils disappeared and never came back. And that is an example in a very practical terms of what can be accomplished by doing work in this area, even with a problem that everyone would see as being very physical, organic, and that most people would attempt to deal with only on the physical level. I think when we have physical disease, there always is a correlate in the realm of consciousness because we are mind bodies. We're not just bodies. It's one thing. Mind and body are two poles or two aspects of the same underlying reality. And that it seems to me it's always appropriate to work in both spheres. So this is one reason why when you're dealing with a condition that's causing chronic pain, we can approach that on the physical level. You can do acupuncture, you can give narcotics, you can try to correct the mechanical situation. But there's also enormous room to do work at the level of the mind and consciousness. And I think this really applies to all medical conditions as well. So in the largest sense, we are all experiencing dis-ease, and the cure for that condition is, again, in this realm of meditation practice. And in the more mundane sense, when we deal with familiar diseases and chronic diseases that come to the attention of physicians, there also is tremendous usefulness for this kind of work. I'm sure that you're all by now convinced of the value of meditation and all wanting to know how to do it. I'd like to hear a little more from Jon Kabat-Zinn about the relationship between meditation practice, mindfulness practice, and health, and specific uses in medical situations. And then we're going to give you some practical advice about how to start a meditation practice.